The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. A few more stats rolling in from the live trumpet lecture on Sunday. Edwin tells me we have 7 visit requests coming from 9 people. That would include 2 couples that want to meet with ministers of the Philadelphia Church of God. This following Sunday's online event, so just a live show that we produce on Sunday, going out to anyone who wants to log on and listen, and to see this kind of response is very encouraging. We had a visit request come in from South Carolina, from Florida, from Nevada, from Canada, Manitoba, Canada, from over in the Philippines, and down in New Zealand as well. And I was told this morning that last time we did this, about a year ago, we had 6 people request visits. Well, I guess 8. So about the same, maybe a little bit more this time around. And all total, it looks like to this point, and we're not quite finished with the count, but we had at least 20 countries represented in the audience on Sunday. But it's looking like that might move up to about the same as it was last year, 28 countries last year. Also, we had between 1,400 and 1,600 unique page views during the live trumpet lecture. That doesn't mean that those were all unique connections, because some may have come in and out a couple, 3 times. But our best estimate is that that, together with the 281 email confirmations we received, would probably indicate that we had a little bit over 1,000 people watching it live. And of course, we played an excerpt from the Trumpet Live lecture yesterday, and we'll have another one for today, about 11 minutes, 30 seconds, that will tuck right into the end of today's program. So if you missed Sunday, if you missed the live lecture on Sunday, you can get another chunk of it here on today's broadcast. It'll be that part where we go through Rod Meredith's book from 1993, and we just compare that with some statements from Herbert Armstrong during his ministry. So that's coming up later on the show. A couple more stats here. 18% of all the non-PCG attendees at the Birmingham PAC, this is just a month ago, 18% of the non-PCG members are now attending with the PCG. Now, we had a pretty small group of non-PCG members, 55 that attended those lectures. I guess when you combine the stats from both nights, 55 who were not in the PCG, 10 of them are now attending. So, of course, all of them or most of them had some pretty good contact with PCG ministers in the lead up to that campaign, but that's still a very strong percentage. If you go back to the London PAC in October of 2018, we now have 10 people attending that were there at the London PAC as non-PCG members. So that's quite exciting. As I said on the live trumpet lecture Sunday, just looking at the UK numbers in general over the past 5 years, we really have had some nice growth. Of course, some of that growth is just the expanding staff and student body that in some cases have come over from other nations, the United States, New Zealand. We've had some families join in on the fun as they've relocated to the UK. But we've also had, particularly in the last couple of years, we've also had some really exciting new growth from within as well. Well, on to the news. Yesterday we had, I guess you could call it a Netanyahu surge The vote counting is still going on in Israel. I think 90% of it is complete. It looks like Netanyahu's coalition will have 59 seats compared to Gantz's 55 seats. So he still is just under that majority threshold. He needs 61 seats, but there's quite a few commentaries coming out of the state of Israel today saying that I don't think any party wants to be part of blowing it up so that there's a fourth election in just the past year. This was the third in the last year. And of course, when you look at the Likud party and compare it to the blue and white party, Netanyahu's party is projected to have 36 to 37 seats compared to Benny Gantz's 32 to 34. And of course, last time they were neck and neck. In fact, Netanyahu was just a little bit below the blue and white party. They had 33 seats in the last one, the blue and white, and then Netanyahu had 32, his Likud party. So to go from 32 up to 36 to 37, that's a pretty strong showing for Benjamin Netanyahu. Here's a prime minister who's under indictment, whose trial is about to begin, and he's calling it last night. He's calling it a giant victory. Netanyahu said, "This is a victory against all odds because we stood against powerful forces. They already eulogized us. Our opponents said the Netanyahu era is over." Well, it's not over. The people have spoken. And the turnout, when you compare this one even to the last one, I think last time it was 69%. The time before that, 60, maybe 67. I forget the exact figures. But yesterday, it was a 71% turnout. So if anything, support for Benjamin Netanyahu is increasing. This is from Yohanan Plesner. He's the president of the Israel Democracy Institute. He said, "While we need to wait for the final results, there is no doubt that Prime Minister Netanyahu has won a significant political mandate from the Israeli people." He went on to say, "Israelis voiced their support for the man they perceive to have brought them security and prosperity. They let their voice be heard. The people have spoken." This, the biggest win of his life. That's what Netanyahu said last evening. "The biggest win of my life." He said, "We plowed the country from north to south. There's nothing like the citizens of Israel. Israeli citizens trust us because they know that we have brought the best decade in Israeli history." See, there's a bit of a resurgence. Some were even greeting the victory last night with cheers of Bibi, King of Israel. That's something we've talked about before. The king of Israel. This last bit from the Jerusalem Post, quoting Netanyahu, he said, "The victory is even sweeter because it was against all odds and we were eulogized. We turned the lemons into lemonade." Here he's going up against Benny Gantz. He's going up against the left-wing media. He's going up against the judicial system as well. Carolyn Glick tweeted out, "The loser of today's election is Israel's corrupt, tyrannical legal fraternity. Today was their Waterloo. The winner is the Jewish people that got up and voted to save our sovereignty and our democracy and rallied behind our leader, Netanyahu. The losers, the tyrannical legal fraternity, the deep state, in other words, the administrative state, they sustain yet another loss." Israel Hayom, another paper in Israel, it says, "Benjamin Netanyahu's resounding win was an equally ringing failure for Blue and White and Benny Gantz. The people have spoken," it says. And then further on, it says, "The law says that," well, let me just back up. It says, "Despite a campaign that went on for over a year and three rounds of voting, during which the prime minister's legal situation went from bad to worse, and during which the main opposition party voiced the single message that Netanyahu cannot be prime minister because of public norms, that they invented for this scenario. The public voted the way it voted, and no message can be clearer. The law says that Netanyahu can serve as prime minister while he is on trial, and on Monday, the public gave him a mandate to do so. So the radical left, how angry are they this morning? They thought he was over and done with. He's about to go on trial. And yet, what do a majority of Israeli citizens think about that? Another sham investigation. That's what it amounts to. Israel Hayom says this is an almost unprecedented personal coup, a comeback the like of which Israeli politics has never seen. Remember, this isn't some shiny new candidate who managed to attract a large following, but the longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history who has reinvented himself. He's the longest-serving prime minister in history, and he's coming under the attack from every direction. And he still comes out on top. He actually posted gains over the previous election. And then last night, in the middle of the night, I think it was 2 a.m., Tel Aviv time, he called it the biggest win of my life. Well, we'll still have to see how this very complicated government, this process, this parliament, this Knesset in Israel split up into so many different factions. It's a wonder they can put together a government at all, ever, as divided as they are. But it's looking like this time around he has the numbers to build a coalition. And we'll certainly keep our eyes on that in Israel. This here from the Times of London. The Taliban returned to bombing days after signing peace deal. How about that one? That didn't take very long. We talked about the peace deal. We made peace yesterday or over the weekend with the Taliban. We talked about it on yesterday's program. We made peace with the Taliban, and then they immediately start bombing. They immediately start murdering people. It says here, an explosion killed three people at a football game in eastern Afghanistan yesterday as the Taliban announced that it was resuming operations against government forces in a severe blow to the historic peace agreement signed with Washington on Saturday. So we had peace going for 3 days, I guess. Saturday, Sunday, the bombing on Monday. 2 days, 2 to 3 days, 48 hours. It says the Taliban called off a truce that had held for a week. What were the sound bites yesterday? I think it was Pompeo, Secretary Pompeo, who was saying, this past week shows what can be accomplished if the Taliban just have the firm resolve to take a stand against violence, against terrorism. Well, I don't mean to make light of it. It's sad and tragic. It shows how hopeless the so-called peace process really is, especially in the Middle East. It says it held for a week leading up to the signing after President Ghani balked at the demand to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners before his own peace talks with the insurgents could begin. And then it quotes this Taliban spokesman who said the reduction in violence period had ended and that military operations would resume against Afghan government forces. As per the agreement, he said, our holy warriors will not attack foreign troops, but our operations will continue against the Kabul administration forces. It says, if our 5,000 prisoners do not get released, there will be no intra-Afghan talks. We went through this yesterday. The U.S., of course, was celebrating on Sunday, signing this deal, but the Afghan government, they're upset about it, and they don't want to let these Taliban prisoners go free. And the Taliban has responded in the way that it knows how to respond, by blowing up people at sporting events. It says this Taliban rep acknowledged that people are enjoying the reduction in violence. We don't want to spoil their happiness, but he added, it does not mean that we will not take our normal military activities back to the level that we were before. It says, again, at the Times, immediately after he spoke, the bomb was detonated at the football match in the eastern province of Khost. Further on in this piece, it says, the Taliban has already driven a wedge between Kabul and Washington by refusing to give the Afghan government a seat in the negotiating table while the terms of the agreement were struck. Taliban leaders hailed, we talked on this yesterday, they hailed Saturday's agreement as a victory. This is a victory for the Taliban, this so-called peace deal. It sets a timetable for the withdrawal of all foreign forces from Afghanistan within 14 months and calls for negotiations on a power-sharing government between the Taliban and Kabul to open a week today. So in just 14 months, and the foreign troops, U.S. troops, they'll make their way out. That's what the U.S. wants. That's what President Trump wants. We just want to get out. We're tired of war. What was that statement from one of those Taliban commanders yesterday? In one of the articles I quoted, he said, hey, you have the watches, you have the gadgets, but we have the time. We'll wait this out. Here they've been taking all of these losses in these skirmishes, one after another, and yet somehow or another they win the war. How is it? How is it that the Taliban can be pushed out, can be scattered, and then as soon as the dust settles, they come right back in and take over? They lose all these battles, and yet they win the war. The U.S., for its part, wins a lot of those small skirmishes, wins a lot of the small battles, and then in the end says, it's too much, 18, 19 years, $1 trillion, 3,000 casualties, 20,000 troops dismembered. And that is tragic. It's sad and tragic. But why no victory? Why no overwhelming victory for the lone superpower on Earth today? It's something more people should consider. Here the U.S. is cutting and running. The focus, you see, the focus is internal. The focus is the United States and the economy and jobs. And of course, when looking at that, you can see why so many Americans are excited. Yesterday, the stock market rebounded in a massive way, the single greatest point gain in history, an all-time daily high, up over 5%, 1,293 points. That's some kind of surge after the coronavirus scare. I think it was on a seven-day run of losses, the market. Well, yesterday, investors evidently thought, you know what? Maybe some of those stories we quoted yesterday had something to do with it. You know, as uneasy as coronavirus makes us feel, when you compare it to H1N1, when you compare it to even some of the more recent epidemics, it's nowhere near that, at least not yet. And 3-4%? I saw a clip just yesterday. I forget which recent epidemic the commentator was talking about, but it was one not that long ago where the death rate was 10%. If you caught this virus, 1 in 10 died from it. Well, right now, as I noted yesterday, with the coronavirus, it's between 3 and 4%. Quite a few people are recovering from it. And yet still, look at the way the radical left, and when you say the radical left in the U.S., you're talking about the Democratic Party, and you're talking about the Democrat media complex. Look at how they seized upon this epidemic as an opportunity to beat up President Trump. The same president who was clamping down on flights into the U.S. just a couple weeks into this virus, just a couple weeks into this epidemic. Even when those on the left were saying, well, he's a racist for turning away those flights from China. Then a few weeks later, they say, you know what? He's not prepared. He didn't do enough. It's as if they just carry right on. Every day is the beginning of the world. Every day is the beginning of history. Their comments from just 2, 3, 4 weeks earlier condemn them. How much longer before these comments, the one from this montage we're about to play, how much longer before these comments condemn them, if not already? Here's the news media just piling it on Donald Trump. He's the cause of this virus. He's the cause of this problem. Clip one.
We have a crisis of coronavirus, and President Trump has no plan.
What he's doing is late, too late, anemic.
Mr. Trump is late.
As soon as this virus started cropping up elsewhere in the world, we should have been on top of it.
Do you trust, and should Americans trust, President Trump to deal with this crisis?
No.
This is an administration that does not believe in science, and so I'm not surprised that he's completely clueless.
Look, the president we know is not a scientist, and that's a nice way to put it. He doesn't even believe in science.
This president hasn't allowed his scientists to speak. The idea that the experts are not allowed to speak, the president has silenced them, Dr. Fauci.
I'm not being muzzled. I was cleared here, and here I am talking to you, and I'll give you the whole truth the way I always have.
I've been talking about this for a while. They don't even have a test kit.
Well, we've already tested over 3,600 people here in the United States. I'm not sure what he meant when he said there's no lab kit.
You know, the idea that Donald Trump said just several days ago this was a Democratic hoax, what in God's name is he talking about? Has he no shame?
The Trump administration has been asleep at the wheel.
We know he doesn't have the capacity or the competence to handle such moments.
I cannot think of a worse person to put in charge of dealing with this coronavirus.
And his response has been pathetic.
This is not a Democratic hoax. This is incompetence on the part of the President of the United States.
And his incompetence really does put us all at risk.
President Trump, good morning. There's a pandemic of coronavirus. Where are you? Where is your plan?
That's put together by our friends at Grabian. Where is President Trump? He's been everywhere, holding press conferences, sending out Mike Pence, putting forward, what's the name of the doctor? Fauci, I guess it was. He's not being muzzled. They had some actions right from the start and faced withering criticism because of it from these Democrats that think they have all the solutions. I heard one yesterday say that if I was president, this would not be happening. This would not be happening, this virus, right? Well, today they have their Super Tuesday primaries. 14 states are in play. A total of 1,357 delegates. And you see what's been happening among the Democrats in the last few days with Klobuchar bowing out and Buttigieg and no doubt colluding with the Democrat Party and former Vice President Biden. This is a party that's, at the moment, they're more afraid of Bernie Sanders than they are of President Trump. Lots of collusion going on behind the scenes. Quid pro quo, as President Trump said yesterday. If you give me this, if you give me this endorsement, I'll give you this in return. That's what's going on. Now, there's still plenty of Trump derangement to go around. Don't worry about that. But they are afraid of Bernie Sanders, the self-proclaimed socialist, really the communist. He has a proud history of supporting communist states, of praising communists. That clip we played the other day where he was complimentary of the Russian transport system. I heard that again on radio yesterday somewhere, and he was talking about the subway stations and how beautiful they were and how much art there was in the subway stations. He loves communist Russia and Cuba, Venezuela, and on it goes. Victor Davis Hanson had a great piece on the new impeachment rules and how that, if we go by this, President Obama would have been impeached over and again. I'll leave it to you to look at that yourself. You can see the article there on the YouTube stream Hansen said at the end, though, Obama was not impeached, not because he did not do things that are now defined as impeachable, but because his opposition in the House did not do what Democrats later most willingly did, attempt a coup to remove a president without cause. If that was the aim back during the Obama years, well, there was plenty of ammunition to go after him. Plenty of opportunities, judging by today's standards, to impeach Barack Obama. But there's new rules now. The Democrats have established that. And so the president is getting impeached for things like making a phone call to Ukraine and suggesting that the Biden family should be investigated. That now is an impeachable offense. Dennis Prager's website, he had a video recently, I don't know if it was yesterday or in recent days, but he asked the question, why are young people so unhappy? It's a great little video. Most of his videos are pretty educational and informative, those five-minute pieces that he puts out. But this one, of course, got our attention because we do keep our eyes on these discouraging, depressing statistics. What's happening to our youths, our children? Why so many of them are committing suicide? Why so many of them are discouraged and despondent? Here's Dennis Prager with a bit from his five-minute video, clip two.
Why are so many young people unhappy? To cite just one example, Reuters reported in 2019 that suicidal thinking, severe depression, and rates of self-injury among U.S. college students more than doubled over less than a decade. And unhappiness is hardly confined to Americans. As the social commentator Kay Heimowitz recently wrote, Germans are lonely, the bon vivant French are lonely, and even the Scandinavians are lonely. The British Prime Minister recently appointed a Minister of Loneliness. People have more money, better health, better housing, more education, and live longer than at any time in history. But people, especially the young, are unhappier than at any time since data began to be collected. Why?
Yes, why? Why is it this way? Why the paradox? All of this wealth, we live longer than we used to. So much prosperity, jobs to go around under this administration, and yet so much unhappiness. He alluded to suicide rates. Prior to 2007, suicide rates were actually going down and had been for two decades. But in the decade that followed, there was a spike, 56%. It jumped 56%, the suicide rates in the United States. Teen depression spiked 63% over the same period. And yet, as good as some of these conservative commentators are, and even that video to some degree, he does talk about values and purpose. And we'll expand on that in greater detail here in just a minute. But most people just don't recognize the true cause of this unhappiness. Mr. Prager highlights a few reasons for this in his view. Here's clip three.
There are any number of reasons: increased drug and opioid addiction, less human interaction because of constant cell phone use, and young people's fears for their future are the most widely offered explanations. But the biggest reason is the loss of values and meaning.
The loss of values and meaning. That made me think of what Herbert Armstrong said in Missing Dimension and Sex about why all this violence and immorality. He asked a similar question in his 1981 book. Why so much violence and immorality? Here is the cause. Mr. Armstrong identified it. Human nature, which is vanity, without any purpose, and the absence of parental training and discipline. So there's the values, and then, of course, the purpose. That's the meaning in life. Human nature, the pull of the devil, the prince of the power of the air. He surcharges the air with his attitudes, with his impulses. And then you add to that the hopelessness. There's no purpose. What are we teaching our young people about their future? Even if just the future for America. So many of them hate America. So many of them are told that all the problems in this world are because of America. Their country is essentially evil, they've been told. The New York Times, talking about the increase in suicides among young, it says, how is it possible that so many of our young people are suffering from depression and killing themselves when we know perfectly well how to treat this illness? That's the New York Times. How could this be? We know perfectly well how to treat this illness. Really? Really? I don't even know what they get. I didn't read the whole article, but they know perfectly well? Where is the humility? Where is the, you know, maybe we're doing something just flat out wrong. Maybe we haven't thought of something. But I'm sure the Times is thinking we've got all this prosperity. We have all of these government programs. We have all of these psychotherapists. How could the increase in suicides, how could that be happening? Well, the truth is they don't know the cause. They can't identify the cause. Mr. Armstrong did. He says there's no sense of purpose today. We're told we must adjust to living in a world of problems with no solutions. Nuclear war, the erasure of human life from Earth, appears to be just around the corner, liable to strike us at any second. It says young people are given nothing to live for, no hope, no future. They're more prosperous than ever before, but they're bored. They're rebellious. The spirit of revolt is in the air. They resent all authority. That's the truth. He wrote that in 1981. And look at where we are today. Look at what the New York Times wrote recently. Look at this video put out by PragerU. Here's how Dennis Prager concluded his video, clip 4.
Young people have been told God is nonsense. Their country is essentially evil. Their past is deplorable. Their future is bleak. And marriage and children are not important. Why are so many young people depressed, unhappy, and angry? It's not capitalism or income inequality or patriarchy or even global warming. It's having no religion, no God, and no country to believe in. And what does that leave them with? No meaning. But there is always Instagram.
There's his conclusion. There's always Instagram. There's always Facebook. There's always whatever else it is, Twitter. I don't know all the new ones for the young people, but they've got a new one, it seems, every few months. There's something there to fill the void, but it doesn't. It doesn't fill the void. It just makes them more hopeless. It makes them more unhappy. They don't have purpose in the incredible human potential. Mr. Armstrong wrote about this most necessary of all knowledge. He said it's the knowledge of what man is, the knowledge of why he is, the purpose for which humanity was put on earth, the knowledge of the way to achieve that purpose, of the way to world peace, peace between individuals, groups and nations, it says. The knowledge of the cause of all the world's troubles and evils. It says the knowledge of the solution to all these problems. The knowledge of the true values, what's important and what's worthless. He said that is the missing dimension in knowledge. That's what's missing in education today. That's what's missing in families today. Our young people, they're not being taught their awesome purpose, their incredible human potential. They're not being given this revelation from God. Hebrews 2, Psalm 8, Romans 8, these are some of the passages that expound upon our universe potential. In Romans 8, 18, Paul said, "For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us." It's not even worth comparing
the sufferings and the trials that I've gone through. And he went through a lot. He was executed in the end. He lost his head. And yet Paul, in his last book, he said, there's a crown waiting for me. I've qualified. I'm going to rule with Christ. This was a victory, the way he viewed it. To die in Christ. He believed. This was a man of faith. And David was the same way, of course. I'll leave it to you to read through Romans 8 and this incredible universe potential that we have. Romans 8, where it talks about the whole creation groaning and waiting for the birth of the first fruits. My father, in a program back in 2013, a program titled The Incredible Human Potential, he expounded on this passage in Romans 8, where the universe is groaning for the first fruits. Clip 5.
Only people that think and act like God and have the very character and mind of God would beautify that universe and take away that decay and that massive groan of the universe, waiting for what? Waiting for the appearance of the sons of God. Can you imagine what that means? And what that's saying about you and your potential? Think universe. Think ruling over the universe forever after ruling the earth. That's what God wants you to do. That's why you're on this earth, to be a member of God's family and do that work. That's what it's all about.
There's your values and meaning. That's your purpose. The incredible human potential that fills our lives with meaning and with purpose, with happiness and joy. It motivates us to purify ourselves, as 1 John 3 says. Every child needs this purpose. They need to be taught this inspiring purpose. They need to wrap their arms around this foundational teaching. Comes right out of your Bible, fills our life with purpose, with substance. When we come back, we'll conclude with a few emails from you listeners and also the excerpt from Sunday's live trumpet lecture. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Untold thousands of professing Christian ministers have, over the centuries, preached Christ. They have professed to be his ministers, to represent him. They have said Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, but they have withheld Christ's gospel. Thus, the vast majority of people on earth have been deceived by false gospels. The Incredible Human Potential reveals how men were deceived about the truth of the gospel, and it makes plain what the good news of the true gospel really is. The true gospel of God's coming kingdom is directly concerned with world conditions as they are, with human nature, its source and origin, with world evils, suffering, unhappiness, with world peace. It's concerned with government, with the reason present human governments fail to be the benefactors of their peoples they are supposed to be. This all-important subject is thoroughly explained in Herbert Armstrong's book, The Incredible Human Potential. Request The Incredible Human Potential today. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
some email feedback from you, the listener. This one says, this recent lecture, the Sunday lecture, is most timely. Well done. It was just like a fine wine. That sounds good. This one here says, hi, I thought I'd drop you a line. I live in New York. I love to play your show in my medical taxi and spread the word. I can't believe where this world is headed, and I'm praying for you and your father. So hopefully the occupants in his medical taxi aren't shocked to death by the message they hear from the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Another one here says, I'm so grateful for your live lecture on Sunday. I was fortunate enough to have attended Imperial School in Big Sandy. I was at SEP in Minnesota when Mr. Armstrong announced the closing of the school. That year I was in the sixth grade. My parents divorced and I was with my mom. I was constantly told the church was a cult. I was made to go to a Baptist church for 10 years. I was away from the church. I came across your program 2 years ago, and something told me to pick up my Bible and start studying and praying. It says, I'm currently reading Mystery of the Ages. This is an eye-opening book. I have a long way to go. I'm praying and repenting for my past and present sins. I see everything unfolding, as Mr. Armstrong said. I remember him saying to blow the dust off our Bibles and to study it. I want to come back to the church. Your dad's weekly show and your daily program are a true blessing and are helping me a lot. So that's some very encouraging feedback from one of our listeners. Another one here says, we watched your broadcast, your live trumpet lecture this morning. We had the parents on the phone listening because they had some technical problems getting online at their home. It was a bold message that certainly challenges the Laodiceans. And I'm glad that it does. That comes from Texas. And this one here says, I kept thinking and talking about your lecture, following it on Sunday. My wife and I mentioned how loving the delivery was. Certainly it proved how much God loves the Laodiceans and wants them back in his fold. God wants them back. Yes, indeed. Another one here says, just a short note to say many thanks to you and to your team for the eye-opening work being done in putting this life-saving message out in society. I was truly impressed with your message on the hoax surrounding the use of plastic bags, etc., which has been foisted onto our society. I was inspired with how you compared the contamination of our, or the pollution of our rivers, oceans, and such. Such that it, based on what we allow into our minds and our bodies, that we would suffer the same fate, it says, and then you aptly gave the solutions. Great job. That's from Barbados. Another one here says, good morning, Mr. Fleury and company. Listening to you from my home by myself in Los Angeles. I'm a regular listener during the week for at least a year now. Have a great show, and thank you for your insight and your free literature. And then this last one here comes from our friends in Abu Dhabi. It says, this is regarding Sunday's live trumpet lecture. It says, all the camera angles, transitions, promos, etc. were flawless. Very impressive. I know God and Christ are pleased with the result. The message was powerful, a powerful appeal to our Laodicean brethren. I always felt that your father has a knack for pleading to the Laodiceans, whereas Mr. Armstrong was more of a teacher to the public, and now I see the pleading in your messages more clearly as well. Hopefully the Laodicean brethren will see that their late leader was not following Mr. Armstrong. It says those quotes were devastating. Well, speaking of those quotes, that's what's included in this next clip from Sunday's live lecture. This is about 11 minutes worth of the live presentation we had on Sunday, and we'll conclude today's program with the video. I just want to take you through some quotes from a booklet back in 1993 to just help you to see where some of this corrupt thinking about God's purpose and plan, His church, His government, where it came from. And I don't want to put all the or pinpoint the cause of it on just this booklet alone. But this booklet, it was produced by the late Rod Meredith back in 1993. Church Government and Church Unity. This was the booklet where he talked about collegial government. And my father responded to that pretty strongly in God's Family Government. And then the booklet was withdrawn from circulation in the church that Mr. Meredith raised up. And the excuse was that, well, the term we use, collegial, it was an unfortunate term to be used, and we should have had a better word, I guess. But if you go through that booklet and you see some of the statements that were made, not just with respect to collegial, but all through the booklet from cover to cover, statements made about God's church, about God's government, you can see why there's so many people today who are confused. Because this was the thinking of even a prominent minister back in the early 1990s, someone who worked at the feet of Mr. Armstrong for quite a number of years. Mr. Meredith wrote, again, this is from 1993, he said, Mr. Armstrong knew, and many of us who have studied church history know, that in fact, very seldom in its 2,000-year history has God's church ever had one administration with one man in charge. He says, very seldom in 2,000 years has there ever been one administration with one man in charge. Now, that's what he said. And just compare it. Compare it to what Mr. Armstrong said. This is from 1981. At this point, we need to understand a principle, Mr. Armstrong says, by which God always has worked through humans. He has always worked through one man at a time. What a difference. What a difference. You make the comparison. He worked through Abraham. He worked through Moses, through Joshua, through one judge at a time, through Samuel, through David, through Solomon. He worked through Peter. And when Peter had left the Middle East, through Paul. These men had, in greater or lesser number, staff assistants unto them. But God's work was through the one man at a time. Now, that previous quote that I gave to you from Mr. Meredith's 1993 booklet, he said Mr. Armstrong knew that very seldom in 2,000 years history of the church has God worked through one administration or one man at a time. That just simply wasn't the truth. And you can see that in this quote, and I could bring up probably a dozen or two dozen others that make this same point, right from Mr. Armstrong's teachings. You can see why, as I say, so many people early on became confused about church government, about the one true church. But look, all you have to do is go back to what Herbert Armstrong taught, and you can know the truth. Let me take you back to the 1993 booklet, Mr. Meredith's booklet, Church Government and Church Unity. He says, if we look into the New Testament with an open mind, we find a totally different approach to government than what has developed in the church. That's quite a statement. If we look, he's talking about what has developed in the church all through the years of Herbert Armstrong, and I guess the years right after his death. But he says, in the New Testament, there's a totally different approach to government than what has developed in the church during the days of Mr. Armstrong. So Mr. Armstrong, I guess, got it wrong. Mr. Armstrong didn't really understand God's government. That's what that's saying. Another one. Unwittingly, we have been rather careless in using the term government of God. This term never appears as such in the Bible, and certainly not in connection with the New Testament church organization or government. The government of God, there's not a connection between the New Testament church organization and God's government. Now think about Jesus Christ as the head of the church. He established the church. He established it. He's the one who said, now, Peter, you're the chief apostle. You're the chief
among the others, here's Jesus Christ, building his church. We'll talk more about that in the next segment. Establishing his authority. That sounds very much like Jesus just abandoned the church and left it over to the vicar of Christ. That's what you hear in one of the biggest churches, the biggest Christian churches of today. Jesus did not abandon his church. He established it. He is the head. He's the one that organized it and structured it to be based upon God's government, God's purpose, God's plan. One more statement here. It says, as we have already briefly noted, the annals of church history make clear the fact that very seldom, if ever, have all of God's people in the New Testament church been led by one church government under one man. So that was the genesis, the origin of this thinking that, well, there's many different branches, there's many different leaders, there's many different men, and you can go and you choose which one that you want to be a part of. And many have done that. And many, as I say, even come to the PACs and say, well, I really appreciate your work, but, you know, I'm fine where I am. And everything's fine here, and we've all got the truth, and God will bring us together. This 1993 booklet, again, it says, down through history, Christ has guided his church so that often, in fact, most of the time, there were different branches of the truth, true church, coexisting at the same time. Different branches of the church coexisting. Again, just look into the Bible. Look at the first century. Look at before that. Look at the work of Urijah. He was preaching some of the same things as Jeremiah. But when the trial set in, Urijah, he ran. He didn't have the faith that Jeremiah had. He didn't support Jeremiah's work. He wanted to do his own work. He thought he was doing it very similar to the way Jeremiah did it. God wasn't with him. Again, I just want to refer you to chapter 6 of Mystery of the Ages. People have forgotten some of the truth in that book. A couple more quotes here. It says, in the past, we, and I include myself in this, have mistakenly assumed that Christ directly guides his church so that no serious errors will ever be made and no serious doctrinal deviations will ever occur. We've made the mistake in the past that Christ directly guides his church. That's a shocking statement. Christ does guide his church. That doesn't mean that we've never, as human instruments, that we've never made mistakes or had to come out and correct things that were a little bit off in the past. But Jesus Christ is the head. He's the head. He directly guides the church. Again, let me just help you to see, compare this with what Mr. Armstrong wrote. He says, too many have viewed the Worldwide Church of God and what we call the work as a secular, man-devised organization with its board of directors, its vice presidents, department heads, and positions of authority, some of whom have tried to pull political or corporate business tactics of rug jerking to elevate themselves and grab for power. They have forgotten, listen to this, they have forgotten that the divine, supernatural Jesus Christ, the living Christ, is the head running this work his way. Not the way of this world's corporate enterprises or institutions. To them, God is not in the picture. The people that would say that Christ doesn't really directly guide his church, they see it more as just this sort of corporate man-devised organization where you've got the board of directors, the vice presidents, the department heads. They don't see God in the picture. God has to be at the center. And if you're looking for God's church, look for an organization that's doing his work, that's producing fruit, that has his government. Look for an organization where God is in the center. That's what you want. Everything revolves around the head. The head directs the body. Now, as I say, when you read some of these quotes back from the early 1990s, when there was a lot of confusion among the Laodicean brethren, we all went astray, but God had a solution. Many people didn't accept it, though, and they went their own way. They followed, so, and they said, I'm of this man, or I'm of this man, I'm of this minister over here, I'm of this apostle. Paul would say to that, is Christ divided? Let me just give you one last quote. This is not from his booklet, but a letter he wrote in 1994. Mr. Meredith said, "So, are God's people being scattered and not all under one administration? Yes, that is clearly the case now and has probably been so through all the church eras. Yes, we're all scattered and that's kind of the way it's always been. Since the body of Christ, the church of God, is a spiritual organism, who can say absolutely that all Philadelphians are in one organized group?" So there's Christians, there's Philadelphians everywhere. That's what he was saying. This was a leading minister in the Worldwide Church of God before Mr. Armstrong died. And he was saying a few years after Mr. Armstrong died that there's true Christians, Philadelphians, scattered all over the place in all these different organizations. And so that's why. It's because so many of the leaders were saying it following the death of Herbert Armstrong. That's why we still encounter people that say, well, it's just fine to be wherever. That's what they've been told. I would urge you, as I keep saying, go back to what Mr. Armstrong wrote. Go back to chapter 6 of Mystery of the Ages. Look at some of the history of what's happened in God's church.